Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everybody. Okay, we are continuing with the study of the Samaditti Sutta. This is Sutta number 9 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And now we have come to the, it's actually a series of sections, sort of connected one to the other, a series of sections which defines the causal structure of the well-known formula of dependent origination. And last time we started, as the sutta itself begins, at the end or bottom of the sequence of conditions, with aging and death, tracing aging and death back to birth, and from birth to existence. I just want to clear up what might have been a possible misunderstanding about something that I said last week, when I said that the definitions of aging, death, and birth that we find in the suttas are not intended to describe events that take place at the level of a single mind moment. What I was saying was to discourage interpretations of this formula of dependent origination in the suttas, which take the expressions aging and death and the formulations of it in terms of a person being born, growing old and dying, which take that to be just metaphors for what happens at the level of individual states of consciousness. Now, in saying that, I don't mean to say that these particular links or factors in dependent origination don't apply to individual states of mind. Of course, all conditioned phenomena, everything in existence, in conditioned existence, undergoes arising and ceasing. And so one can take the expressions birth and take birth as production or arising, and death as vanishing or ceasing. And then one could take the period of existence between birth and its, between its production and its vanishing, between its production and its disappearance, as the process of aging. And in fact, within the Abhidhamma, one finds, in one of the books of the Abhidhamma, one finds a treatment of dependent origination which applies it to individual mind moments and uses the terms of the formula, the 12 terms of the standard formula. But the definitions of birth, aging, and death there are somewhat different. First, it's speaking about on the occasion of a particular mental event, a citta. It's not speaking about beings, the way in the suttas, beings in the different orders of beings, in the various orders of beings. But it's speaking about an individual cittupada, a mental event. And it says, what is, on the occasion of a particular mental event, what is birth? It is the birth, the genesis, the production, full production, manifestation of the various mental phenomena on that occasion. This is called birth. What is aging? There's no mention here of descent into the womb, no mention of beings coming into the various orders of beings. Okay, then what is aging? Aging is the aging, the decay, the decline of vitality of the various mental phenomena on that occasion. This is called aging. No mention of brokenness of teeth, grayness of hair, wrinkling of skin, weakening of the sense faculties, because those are just completely inapplicable to a mind moment. Then on that occasion, what is death? And this is the most radically divergent definition. The definition doesn't even use, in defining death, it doesn't even use any of the standard synonyms for death in the sutta definition, but it says simply it is the destruction, vanishing, breakup, full breakup, impermanence, disappearance of the various dhammas, the various mental phenomena on that particular occasion. That is called death. So that is the application of these terms in the Abhidhamma using a different method from the suttas, what is called the Abhidhamma method as distinct from the sutta method. But the sutta method, as found in the standard definition of dependent origination, is not speaking about events taking place at the level of mind moments, but is speaking about what happens to beings, that's satta, sentient beings, living beings, in the various orders of beings, the different communities or different realms of sentient beings. Okay, we went through aging and death to birth, and we came to being or existence. And I explained last week that in the Theravada commentarial tradition, existence is understood to mean, especially understood when existence is taken to be a condition for birth, existence, bhava, is understood to mean the karmic, what I call the karmically active side of existence. That side of existence in which we are creating karma with the potential to bring new existence in one of the three domains or realms of sentient existence. Sense sphere existence, the fine material sphere existence, or immaterial existence. And last week I also gave quotations from other Buddhist traditions which show that this understanding of bhava or being is not something peculiar or unique to Buddhaghosa and the Theravada commentators, but we find it in Master Yunshun, who's probably drawing upon, could it be Abhidhamma Kosha Bhasha, I don't know, or Asanga's Yogacara Bhumi, one of his works from the Northern Indian Abhidhamma tradition. And then we find it, this understanding of bhava or existence, in Tsongkhapa, who is the great commentator in the Gelugpa school of Tibetan Buddhism, who is probably drawing upon, it could be also the Abhidhamma Kosha and Yogacara Bhumi. And so this understanding of bhava, of existence, was part of, we could call it, the shared understanding in the different interpretative traditions. Probably that way of explaining bhava had already arisen before the traditions went their separate ways, though also it might have arisen in one tradition and then been accepted by the others. The commentaries like Visuddhimagga make a useful distinction between two aspects of bhava, which they call, I'll write the words on the board in a moment, kama bhava, which is what I've been calling the karmically active side of existence, and upapatti bhava, which means, I would call it simply the passive side of existence, or let us say it's the karmically resultant side of existence. That's the better phrase. Literally it means rebirth existence, but it doesn't refer only to the moment of rebirth, but it refers to that whole side of existence in which we are reaping the fruits of our past karma. And so we have these two aspects of existence. Okay, when we make this distinction between kama bhava, the karmically active side of existence, and what is called upapatti bhava, that is the karmically resultant side of existence, then we could take these three types of bhava, three types of existence, and put them on both sides of this dichotomy, of this distinction. So here the kama, the sense sphere bhava, can be sense sphere karma. That's the karma with the potential to bring a rebirth into sense sphere existence. And it can also be existence within the sense sphere itself. So right now, as we are living here, our day-to-day life, sitting here, we are in the human realm. The human realm belongs to the sense sphere realm. So right now we are within which of the three resultant bhavas? It's a difficult question. Which of the three resultant spheres of existence are we within? You're a professor, you should. Okay. We are within the human realm. The human realm belongs to sense sphere existence. And so, if we want to draw inferences, what do you kind of karma brought us into? What kind of karmically active existence brought us into this human realm? Right. Diplomats not allowed. Okay, then let me just, so the actions that we perform at an ordinary sort of mundane day-to-day level, we say those are sense sphere karmas. Now the fine material, what's called the karmas of the fine material sphere, that would be the development of the jhanas, the four jhanas. And when those jhanas are developed, mastered, and still retained at the time of death, then that mind becomes, the mind that's accustomed to the jhana becomes a very powerful mind, very bright, luminous, clear, bliss, could be blissful, peaceful. So that kind of powerful mind will push to the side the ordinary little sense-bear karmas that the person ordinarily performs, which are not morally significant, and that will generally take on the role of determining rebirth. And where will that create a rebirth? In what sphere or domain of existence? Right. It will produce fine material rebirth existence. And so the person will then continue to exist within the fine material sphere. Is that right? You Brahmas up there and the fine material? Okay, then, if a meditator is dissatisfied even with the very subtle matter and form experiences in the jhana and wants to go further to these very peaceful, very serene and calm states, even beyond bliss and joy, then they will continue the process of mental unification till they enter the arupa jhanas, the formless or immaterial meditative attainments. These are states, we've met them in the text before, states like the base of infinite space, the base of the infinity of consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, when they master the state of formless, one of these formless attainments, they are able to sustain it, then they still have access to it at the time they pass away. That formless attainment will generally take on the role of generating rebirth. And where do you think it will lead to rebirth? Speak loudly. Right, it will produce rebirth in one of the realms of the immaterial sphere of existence, according to the particular meditative attainment that is achieved. That will generally produce rebirth in the realm that corresponds to it. So say the yogi who masters the base of infinite space but doesn't go further, that mind of samadhi will naturally lead to the rebirth into the sphere or plane of infinite space. And similarly with each of the other attainments. Is that right up there? You're faking, because if you're really in the immaterial plane, you can't even hear my voice. It's one of those lower Brahmas pretending that they are in the immaterial plane. Okay, now this rebirth, what's called karmically resultant existence or rebirth existence, actually includes birth, aging, and death. So the existence that is a condition for birth will be the karmically active existence. That is what conditions birth. And birth, the event of birth in the human realm, it's the event of conception, that marks the beginning of karmically resultant existence or rebirth existence. And then the whole process of development from birth through aging and death, we could say in a general sense, will be the karmically resultant existence, except that within the existence, the state of existence. There'll be many occasions when we are creating new karma that is not karmically resultant, that is not determined by previous karma, but those are occasions when we are creating through our own exercise of volition, through our own choices and decisions, our own willed activities, we are creating new karma. And these choices, decisions, they're always conditioned, limited by our previous actions, by external conditions, but they're not completely determined by them. But there's some margin of freedom by which we determine our own destiny. And so in this way, we create our own futures through our own choices, decisions in the present. And those choices, decisions, willed activity, that is the karmic activities of the present that build up our future existence. And so actually, in a sense, we could say almost all of Paticca-samuppada is right there, except for the roots. So we could say that probably when the Buddha was, before his enlightenment, when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, doing the explorations that led to his enlightenment, he probably came to that point where he was able to see how the activities of beings in one life created their future in the next life, and then how their activities in, well, he didn't stay so long so he could see what's going on in their next life, but he would see how in each life a being's activities would create their future. And this way he was able to understand this conditioning process of samsara. But in order to attain enlightenment, he would have to go down further to explore the chain of conditions further to find what are the fundamental roots that keep this process going on, this wheel turning from birth to death, from death to new birth. And it's with this that we come to the next section of the sutta. Now we come to section 32. Okay, here now the monks congratulate, or they express their appreciation to Venerable Sariputta for his treatment of existence. And now they say, but friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view and so forth who has arrived at this true Dhamma? And Venerable Sariputta says, there might be, friends. And then he continues, when friends, I just have to refer back to paragraph 30, which states that with the arising of clinging, there is the arising of being. With the cessation of clinging, there is the cessation of being. That I didn't explain last week, but in order to explain that, I want to go to the analysis of clinging first. So now we come back to 33. When, friends, a noble disciple understands clinging, the origin of clinging, the cessation of clinging, and the way leading to the cessation of clinging, in that way he is one of right view, who, etc., etc., has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, that's the condensed teaching. Now, the elaboration. Okay, what is clinging? What is the origin of clinging? What is the cessation of clinging? What is the way leading to the cessation of clinging? Okay, now the important definition or enumeration. Okay, there are these four kinds of clinging. Clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. With the arising of craving, there is the arising of clinging. With the cessation of craving, there is the cessation of clinging. The way leading to the cessation of clinging is just this Noble Eightfold Path, that is right view up to right concentration. Okay, so now we have in paragraph 30, clinging, it's with the arising of clinging that being arises, that being comes to be. And we see that clinging is of four kinds, the four kinds enumerated in paragraph 34. Now, when it's said that clinging is the condition for being, for existence, then one could actually make clinging the condition for either of these, for both of these two aspects of existence. One could say that clinging is the condition for karmically active existence, in that it is through the clinging that we engage in the different wholesome and unwholesome karmic activities that will produce our next existence. Or else we can just go directly from clinging to any of the types of resultant existence and say it is through clinging that we take some form of rebirth, some type of new existence. So clinging, upadana, leads directly to rebirth. It's just when you ask the question, what type of rebirth will clinging lead to? The clinging itself doesn't give the answer, but then one has to bring in what type of karmically active existence has that person been engaged in. I've tried to explore this a little bit analytically, taking the types of clinging and then seeing what types of existence they could lead to, what type of karma they could lead to. Okay, so we start with the clinging to sense pleasures. Okay, if we have somebody who has very strong clinging to sense pleasures, somebody who's intent on enjoying the objects of the senses. Okay, this person, if it's a person with a coarse mind, they might just forget all types of ethical restraints and just blindly pursue their own benefits and advantages. If they get in, this is the type of person, they get work very hard to earn a lot of wealth, then they can use their wealth to surround themselves with luxuries, commodities, to go out to indulge themselves. This is the type of person who doesn't have any kind of scruples, maybe if they're working for a company, of, you know, channeling or funneling funds into their, from the company into their own private account. If And so they're creating unwholesome karma based upon greed. Then if somebody tries to get to interfere with their pursuit of their own advantage, they try to eliminate them. Sometimes they can become very violent. You have these criminals who are form into gangs in order to rob banks, to cheat. What is the motivation? The enjoyment of sense pleasures. We have this, even we have wars between nations. Again, the motive often sense pleasures. All of this described very graphically in its sutta number 13 in the middle length discourses. So in this case, we have clinging to sense pleasures is creating the very heavy, or sometimes moderately heavy, unwholesome sense-sphere karma, which will lead to sense-sphere existence, a new birth in the sense-sphere realm in the lower worlds. So we have the sense-sphere rebirth existence, I think I explained last week, divided between the fortunate realms, that's the spheres of the human realm and the heavenly realms, and the realms of the worlds of misery, the hells, the animal realm, the realm of pretas, of afflicted spirits. Okay, but one might have another person who has a strong clinging to sense pleasures, but also a more refined nature. And so this person will accept views of the law of karma, the cause and effect of action. And that person can be a follower of the Buddha. There were many lay people who were disciples of the Buddha, and they wanted to enjoy sense pleasures in an afterlife. They wanted a heavenly rebirth. That was their aim. And they would come to the Buddha to ask for what is the advice, what is the path leading to a heavenly rebirth. And so the Buddha taught the types of conduct that lead to a heavenly rebirth. And other religions also teach the types of conduct that lead to a heavenly rebirth. This is not the unique preserve of Buddhism. So we have generosity, self-restraint, kindness, compassion, altruism, purity, types of meditation, without going yet to the jhanic level, but it could be a kind of devotional prayer, practicing good speech, kind speech. So all types of good action. So a person like this, motivated by the desire for the long-enduring sense pleasures of heavens, or even to come back into the human realm and to enjoy wealth and high status, engages in this wholesome karma. So in karmically creative, karmically active existence, they're generating wholesome sense-sphere karma that will lead them back into sense-sphere existence in a happy or fortunate state. In this way, it's a clinging to sense pleasures, producing new existence in a clinging to sense pleasures, conditioning wholesome sense-sphere karma, which leads to new existence in the sense-sphere, in a fortunate state. Okay, then we can have clinging to... What was the next clinging here? Clinging to views. Okay, there are some views which are presented as dogmatic ideologies. Some religions say, only we have the true faith, and then others have to be converted. The others are outsiders, heretics, infidels. And we're in a constant sort of tug of war with them. We have to work forcefully to convert them. And so we have this kind of dogmatic, hostile attitude, so that the so-called religious view sometimes becomes almost a psychological camouflage for an aggressive attitude towards others. There's almost very little of spirituality in the religious view, and a lot of hostility and aggression and self-assertion. So here we have views, clinging to views, leading to creation of bad karma, because one looks at others with suspicion and hostility. One sometimes acts forcefully against others, sometimes attacks them physically and verbally. Okay, so this is creating bad karma, bad sense-sphere karma, which will lead to a bad rebirth existence within the sense-sphere. Okay, there can be other views which are clung to. The view that there is an eternal heaven, an eternal all-loving God who has made that heaven and who teaches good practices like generosity, love, compassion. Or it could perhaps be the Buddhist view of karma and its fruit that one clings to with the hope of gaining a heavenly rebirth. And anyway, one clings to this view, one performs good karma because one wants to have, to enjoy a happy rebirth. So in this way, a clinging to views conditions sense-sphere karma, leading to a happy sense-sphere existence. Okay, then, I'm just taking some examples. One might be able to think of other examples. The clinging to rules and observances. Sometimes this is translated rules, rites, and rituals, but I don't think that's quite accurate. Clinging to rules and observances. And this expression actually was originally formulated against the background of the Buddha's time, when what's called silabhatta were the types of practices undertaken by ascetics from other spiritual communities, practices like self-mortification, undertaking long fasts, afflicting the body by going out in the hot sun during the middle of the day, dousing the body in water for long periods of time, going out naked on a cold night and exposing oneself to the very cold frost of the frosty nights. Okay, so one who clings to that particular type of rules and observances is inflicting a lot of harm and suffering upon themselves. They're not harming others, but they're harming themselves with a deluded mind, thinking, if I can just endure so much pain and misery, I'll be wearing off my unwholesome karma, burning up my defilements, and when they're all burned up, my pure soul will suddenly enjoy the bliss of liberation, the bliss of enlightenment. And so this is a kind of diluted view, but it's coupled with certain practices, and so it's put in a class of its own. And so a person who holds this type of rules and observances harming themselves is creating unwholesome karma, leading to an unhappy rebirth existence. There are other types of rules and observances that involve inflicting harm on others. In the Buddha's time, there was the belief amongst the Brahmins that one should perform animal sacrifices. These were the Vedic teachings. And so the Brahmins would say, bring the goats, the bulls, the pigs for the sacrifice. And so the kings would have to bring these animals for the sacrifice and then pay the Brahmins very generously. Okay, so by advocating these types of sacrifices, by performing these sacrifices, one creates unwholesome karma, again leading to a bad rebirth. And in some religions there's a belief if you sacrifice your life to inflict harm upon the infidels, upon the unbelievers, then you get instantaneous rebirth in heaven. It's true. And so there are many people, unfortunately, today who are doing that. That's what's taking place in Iraq right now, why so many of these fanatics are doing these committing these suicide bombings. What is the motivation? They don't want to die just for the enjoyment of dying, but they're led to believe that by dying for the cause, they go right to heaven. They don't even have to wait for hundreds of years till, I don't know, till what, but they go instantaneously and there's paradise. Okay, then comes clinging to a doctrine of self. Yeah.
Clinging to just empty dogma without the unwholesome aspect. Just clinging to a ritual or an observance that doesn't necessarily harm yourself or somebody else.
I would think it's probably a weak, unwholesome state. It's not, I wouldn't say that it creates, I don't think it would create strong, unwholesome karma. But say one just undergoes a particular ritual because it's part of a religion, and so without thinking, one goes through it.
You can just say the empty recited, empty reciting a prayer over and over again because somebody told you to. And just being completely dogmatic. And there's no, say, comprehension or understanding or insight behind it.
My guess is that the state of mind behind it would be a state of mind rooted in delusion. So it's not a very strong or heavy unwholesome karma. It's unwholesome. But it is not one of these really grave or heavy states. I wouldn't say reciting the prayer is unwholesome. If one is just doing it in an unthinking, automatic, ritualistic way, without thinking, but say somebody is reciting a prayer, they might have a belief in an almighty, all-loving God. Okay, now we as Buddhists, we don't accept that belief, but suppose they are reciting the prayer, they see a lot of suffering in human life, so they're praying, "Oh God, please shed the light of your mercy upon this world where so many people are suffering from want, from hunger, from disease, from warfare. Please let there be peace, let there be prosperity, freedom from disease. So when people are developing thoughts like that in their prayer, then they're actually generating wholesome states of mind. These would be states of mind of loving kindness and compassion. And even though there might not be, as, or at least according to our Buddhist belief, one eternal almighty God, but we say that the person is creating through that prayer, creating, we call it positive, wholesome vibrations in, we call it the world sphere, the world vibration sphere, the psychosphere that surrounds the earth, where there might be even powerful devas that respond to his prayers and that help to radiate beneficent vibrational forces upon the world. So we're just thinking of a case, somebody sits there just thinking that, okay, it's 10 to 4 now, 4 o'clock I have to go out, let me just do my 10 minutes, and just, okay, reciting the prayer. Well, I wonder who won the sports match today. Let's see. Adiviso Bhagava Hang Sama Sambuddho Vida Charanasam. Let's see. The soccer results. Thinking, when I get finished with this at 4 o'clock, then I can put on the TV, find out who won the soccer game. And he's just doing it. I have to do my 10 minutes every day. So then it's just a mechanical ritual. Okay, so let's just get through the clinging to doctrine of self. Okay, this is, according to the Buddha, the most powerful underlying clinging, the clinging to some kind of view of self. And particularly the strongest form of this clinging is the eternalist clinging, the clinging to an eternalist view of self, the view that one has some kind of eternal self. Could be an individual soul, or it could be some infinite universal Atman. So this might motivate a person, again, to engage in good, wholesome actions that might lead to a rebirth in the sense-sphere existence. But if they have the view of some kind of deep, underlying, universal self that's to be realized in meditation, this person could then engage in the practice of samadhi meditation and gain states that are the jhanas or equivalents of the jhanas. And then through those jhanic states, that would be the creating the karma of fine material karma or form sphere karma. So by gaining those jhanas, they think, now I've experienced the self, the blissful self, the tranquil self, the Atman. And they enjoy that. They delight in it. And that attainment builds up the karma that will bring rebirth into the fine material realm of existence. That will bring rebirth into the Brahma worlds. And so many of the great meditators within the pre-Buddhist period, we say the sages of the Upanishads, the great Vedantic meditation masters, probably were practicing jhanas based upon this view of a universal self. And it is a subtle clinging to an idea of self which is like the cord or rope that keeps them within the samsara. But because they have gained such a deep samadhi, they don't come back at once to the sense sphere, but they go to the fine material sphere, where they enjoy this bliss and tranquility for long periods of time, imagining now that they are in the universal reality, until so many hundreds or thousands of aeons go by, then the karma is exhausted and come back down to the human realm. And then some, based upon this view of a deep underlying self, some meditators go beyond the form realm to the it, beyond the form jhanas. They go to the immaterial attainments, the formless attainments. And they experience this universal mind, universal consciousness. And there's that subtle clinging to that. And that becomes the base, the sort of cord that leads them to new existence in the in the formless realm, the immaterial realm of existence. It's for this reason that the Buddha again and again stresses the elimination, the exhaustion of all clinging. He says that it's through non-clinging that the mind is free from the asavas, from the influxes. Okay, we didn't get very far down the chain of causation, but it's important to see how these relationships are established within, between these factors and dependent origination. Okay, if there are any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. George?
You mentioned that the ascetics would use self-mortification to undo their karma.
That was a belief, yeah.
Is there a way to undo karma?
According to the Buddhist understanding? I don't think one actually undoes karma, but one, I say that through the accumulation of wholesome karma, one can weaken when one provides a, when establishes or creates a kind of buffer, so that when unwholesome karma does ripen, its ripening is weak, its results are weak compared to the way it would be if one didn't create that buffer of wholesome karma. Then the unwholesome karma, when it ripens, it will be, its impact will be stronger. So one doesn't actually undo the karma, but one creates, sort of dilutes it through creating wholesome karma, and then through the practice of insight meditation or wisdom, as one cuts off the defilements, then one cuts off the opportunities for the unwholesome karmas to ripen. And then eventually, when one gains liberation from the round of from the cycle of rebirths, then all of the unwholesome karmas that might have been accumulated don't have any opportunity to ripen. But some of those unwholesome, strong unwholesome karmas can remain stored up, seeking an opportunity to ripen, and they can ripen even after, it's said, even after many, many aeons, if the conditions have come together, then they gain their opportunity. the most famous case is that of the Venerable, or one of the most famous cases, the Venerable Mahamoggallana, who was the Buddha's, one of the Buddha's two chief disciples. Certainly he had accumulated mountains and mountains of powerful, wholesome karma, because he was a master of all of the jhanas, all of the iddhis. But in, according to tradition or commentaries, in one past life, long, 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 long ago, he had killed his parents, or according to another account, I think started to kill them. And that created the karmic disposition. Because of that, he was reborn in hell. Then after coming out from hell, and then creating many, many wholesome karmas, but there was still a little residue of that unwholesome karma which had not yet matured. And now in his last life as the Buddha's chief disciple, when he was an old man, that karma had come up and was ready to ripen. And the way it ripened, there was a gang of, well, actually, according to the account, there were some rivals of the Buddha who were envious of him. They got a gang of criminals together and plotted with them to have Moggallana killed. And all of those criminals surrounded the dwelling, the place where Moggallana was staying. And Moggallana, when he saw them around, he wasn't afraid, so he wanted to escape, not because he was afraid, but he didn't want them to create the unwholesome karma of killing a chief disciple of the Buddha. So he tried to use his spiritual powers to escape, but suddenly, for the first time, all of his spiritual powers deserted him. He couldn't escape. They were just like they had all just vanished on him. And so the criminals got him, beat him, and then he expired. And so this was that karma from the previous life that now found the opportunity.
What if you would have the mindset that you did not want to commit things or act upon any evil deeds, and you consciously have this mindset, would the karma still have to take effect?
Okay, the question, what if you have a mindset of not wanting to act to if you have a mindset of a true desire to be only pure, not to commit any evil deeds,
can
that keep the old karma from coming back? I would say a state of mind like that would create or tend to create a strong insulation against unwholesome karma. And then to the degree that one builds up that state of mind, if you just think it occasionally, then it's not very strong. It's just like if you want to keep out, say, there are some mischievous boys, you have, say, apple trees in your lawn, you want to keep out some mischievous boys, and instead of putting up a real fence, you just put some posts up, but no crossbars. So if you just have occasional thoughts like that, it's like just putting up the posts. But if you regularly develop thoughts like that, maybe it's like putting up the posts, crossbars, so it will tend to keep those karmas from maturing. But just like the case of the mischievous boys, there could be one especially tough, ingenious, tall boy who'll find a way to climb over the gate, over the fence, or maybe a couple of boys together will get together, and one jumps on this, one climbs up over the back of the other and gets into the over the fence. So even developing good thoughts like that, there's no certain guarantee. Yeah.
The effect of that, the mindset
Okay, does the effect of the ritual depend upon the mindset with which it is done? It depends completely on the mindset with which it is done. So, ritual can be a means of developing wholesome states. What is being sort of considered a clinging is a holding to a particular right, observance, rule, with the belief that just by performing this rule, by observing this rule, by practicing this observance, practicing this ritual, that this will bring spiritual advancement, spiritual liberation. But one can use the ritual as a way of developing wholesome mind states. Then the ritual becomes integrated in a framework of what we call bhavana, which means mental development. So that is what is actually done in Buddhism. So we have rituals which are used as channels for developing states of mind. And also, it's not unique to Buddhism, but other religions too, which have, call it a conscious understanding of the function of ritual, will also see those rituals as a way of developing wholesome states of mind, desirable states of mind. Okay, maybe just one last question. Don't forget, I said that I was just choosing selected examples, so I wouldn't make any kind of very rigid stipulation. Only the clinging to a belief or a doctrine of self can bring the karma that leads to rebirth into the fine and immaterial sphere existence. I just gave examples. But I don't think sensual clinging will lead to rebirth there. Because if a person has sensual clinging, then they don't want those meditative states. Because there's no sense to get into those meditative states, one has to give up sensual desire or sensual pleasures. One could say clinging to a view might lead to rebirth, to those types of practices that will lead to rebirth into those realms. Like maybe a view of, again, this comes similar to a doctrine of self, but say the view of sometimes kind of eternal, yeah, though usually eternalism is framed as a belief in eternal self, but we might say just an eternal reality to be experienced in a particular meditative state without formulating that as the eternal self. But one could experience the eternal divine reality. No, I mean, it's apart from the wisdom teaching of non-self, we could say these are the views which have inspired the sages, the mystics, the yogis through the ages to give up the lower enjoyments and to seek wisdom, not the panya, but we call it a higher wisdom, a higher meditative states, and to develop these states of samadhi. And so the rishis, the mystics, those are the ones who practice these attainments. Okay, so let us close tonight with a little ritual of sharing the merits. That has the ritual done consciously with awareness to develop wholesome mental states, but not only, but to share the merit with the Devas, the Buddhas, or earth spirits, the Nagas, the dragon spirits, and other beings, and asking them to protect the Buddhist's teaching, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.